World Report for December 15th, 2008. Report is an exploration of the anguish and the beauty of international events from a Canadian perspective. Is the Liberal NDP coalition as big a disaster as several recent polls seem to suggest? This morning, World Report has a look at sovereignty, separation, tax havens, and the rule of law. For a lot of Canadians, the sticking point in the Liberal NDP coalition is that it is in league with the Bloc Québécois. I don't know much about the BQ, but I do know one thing I can share. A couple of years ago, I was researching a story on tax havens. Canadian companies use deliberately weak tax laws in places like Barbados or Cyprus or Malta to avoid paying taxes in Canada. It's a big story that is almost completely unreported, like electoral reform or genocide in Darfur, sexual violence in eastern Congo, blood diamonds, or Uganda's multi-million-dollar gold trade. Ralph Nader writes about tax havens. In an article for Counterpunch, he cites Lucy Komisar of the Tax Justice Network in the U.S. She says the tax haven racket is the biggest scam in the world. End of quote. It's one of those inherently international problems that will never be discussed by municipal councils or even provincial legislatures. The OECD has taken up the problem of harmful tax practices and lists 36 countries as tax havens. In 1992, the Auditor General estimated that the existence of tax havens, including but not limited to Barbados, has resulted in hundreds of millions of dollars in reduced Canadian tax revenues. More recent estimates by Statistics Canada run to tens of billions of dollars. Nader's colleague, Lucy Komisar, says that, quote, the corporations and the rich have opted out of the tax system, and estimates that, quote, half of world trade is between various parts of the same corporations, end quote. But this morning isn't a story about tax havens per se. You can find out more by reading the Nader article in Counterpunch or, for Canadian information, Hansard for the House of Commons. In 2005, Bev Oda was the Conservative Party's Canadian heritage critic. During the first session of the 38th Parliament, she introduced what is the most comprehensive and detailed information I have seen about tax havens in any jurisdiction. The point for now is to understand that this is not an inherently left or right-wing, liberal or conservative issue. But since the Conservatives came to form the government in 2006, they haven't said much about it. However, one party has consistently raised the issue and introduced motions in the House to restrict or eliminate the use of tax havens. In 2001, Mr. Yvan Loubier, who was at that time the finance critic for the Bloc Québécois, raised this matter. Again in 2003, Pierre Paquette moved that in order to ensure tax equity, the government should terminate Canada's tax convention with Barbados, a tax haven which enables wealthy Canadian taxpayers and companies to avoid their tax obligations and should play a leadership role at the international level in activities to eliminate tax havens. Again, in 2005, BQ Member of Parliament Mr. Guy Côté presented a similar motion. Like so many groups, the mainstream media characterizes as extremist. The defining characteristic, in this case, tearing Canada apart, or some vividly overstated version of the same idea, is really a conclusion reached after years of defeat, marginalization, misrepresentation, stonewalling, and indifference on numerous other issues of importance. often there is a debate within the extremist group about the value of democracy and even nonviolence as opposed to armed resistance. But here we see the so-called separatist persistently advancing a position for the benefit of Canada as a whole. Whether the Liberal NDP coalition with BQ's support survives or not, it may be time to start choosing the less inflammatory terminology for framing the issue of Quebec sovereignty. If we look at sovereigntist-separatist movements around the world in Chechnya, say, or Tibet, or Xinjiang province, the Iwo in Nigeria, the Basques, or Irish Republicans, to name just the best known, Canada has fared especially well in finding a political accommodation within parliamentary democratic traditions. In the last week or so, Stephen Harper has used the word separatist to stoke fear in the West that the only item on the Bloc's agenda is to separate from Canada, and that the Bloc would use their position in the coalition to gain concessions, especially in the form of a disproportionate amount of taxpayers' money for Quebec. But when speaking in French, he uses the word souverainiste, or sovereigntist. The CBC's Peter Mansbridge pursues the question with the Nationals At Issue panel. Chantal Hébert of the Toronto Star, Alan Gregg of Decima Harris Research, and Andrew Coyne of Maclean's.
Harper calls them separatists in English. He calls them sovereignists in French. The exact same address tonight, with the exception, as Keith pointed out, of that word. Does that ring in any way in Quebec? Does that make a difference?
Oh, yes, it does. Because, as you know, Jean Chrétien would always use the word separatist, but he'd do so in French and English. And it's a choice that people make. Sovereigntists are called sovereigntists in the same way that New Democrats are New Democrats and not socialists. That's how they choose to be described. So people in Quebec have picked up on that.
For Terry Noble at the Globe and Mail, sovereigntist is politically correct and deceptive. Separatist is the truth and the real word. Norman Spector takes sovereigntist, separatist, secessionist, and splittist to mean the same thing, but with different connotations. Sovereigntist is positive, separatist negative, and secessionist, he seems to suggest, is neutral. Sovereigntist, he says, is a positive word that emphasizes the country they hope to construct, rather than a negative word, separatist, that emphasizes the country they would deconstruct. But secession is the word used to describe an especially destructive American form of separation that resulted in the most lethal war ever to occur in the Western Hemisphere, the American Civil War. Blogger Impudent Strumpet looks at the terms from a linguistic perspective and agrees that separatist is negative and sovereigntist positive, but she goes on. Quote, separatists want to break away from something to which they belong, to destroy an existing union. The connotations are usually a bit extremist and a bit irrational. Think Basque separatist, white separatist, black separatist, Tamil separatists, and so forth. Sovereignty, on the other hand, is a good thing. One's sovereignty over one's own body, Canada's sovereignty over its northern waters. Sovereigntists want to preserve their existing rights and freedoms. They are two separate concepts. They are separate concepts in most parts of the English-speaking world, and they are separate concepts in cognate languages, including French. End quote. She attributes no motive to Harper for using the negative connotation in English and the positive one in French, but Harper is clearly trying to frighten Anglophones with the dual socialist and separatist bogeymen, and he's trying to woo Quebec voters. Whenever Albertans don't get their way, threats of separation pop out of the woodwork. Fully believing that they are the West, Albertans have forged a theory of Western alienation from this feeling. More serious are the sovereigntists, those in Quebec and among First Nations, whose call is for territorial self-determination. Sovereignty differs from separation. We all claim some form of sovereignty, as Impudent Strumpet points out, over our bodies, our minds, our personhood. Canadians assert sovereignty in the Arctic and worry that their sovereignty is threatened by NAFTA, the Security and Prosperity Partnership, and negotiations for a North American Union. As Chantal Hébert suggests, this may not be the final form of
but the
coalition.
Concept of a coalition, which is foreign to this country, was still, when the dust settled, was still advanced. Not this coalition, the wrong one at the wrong time, but these arrangements will become, the discussion of them will become less foreign, and probably in time this will have been a step forward.
At least some liberals are not ready to shut down tax havens. Martin's shipping companies made extensive use of them, for example. Some conservatives, on the other hand, probably are. The NDP doesn't appear ever to have addressed the issue and cannot really be said to have much of a serious philosophy of taxation. But we all understand sovereignty, and we understand the breakdown of democracy.
Well, in theory, citizen engagement, and we have seen that, there's no question. I mean, you don't need to be a pollster anecdotally. It's overwhelming. Is a good thing, because at the end of the day, this is, you know, the final bulwark against arbitrary and bad government. Unfortunately and tragically in this instance, I mean, the extent to which the population has been agitating, they've been agitating as much against one another. Western Canada against Central Canada, separatists against federalists, in a very, very unhealthy way. And that, I would think, at bottom, the major conclusion Canadians have reached is one of disgust, and causing them to feel even more distant from those people they elect to lead them.
Andrew, do you buy into that? And I ask you that. There's no doubt that the people were engaged.
It's going to be more midterm. And Chantal started going there last night. And the fact of the matter is that sooner or later, these birds have got to figure out how to make minority government work. And not just in this parliament, for the foreseeable future. And that the extent to which it doesn't work, sooner or later, he's going to become the problem and people will turn off on him.
Just recall, for instance, these excerpts from the APTN town hall meeting about the duty to consult played several weeks ago. APTN's Cheryl McKenzie talks to Samuel McKay and Robert Lovelace from Akwesasne Mohawk Territory.
We're not asking for permission from the provincial or the federal government whether we can do that or not. We are just doing it because we're a sovereign nation, because only sovereign nations can sign treaties. And Treaty Number 9 was signed in our community in 1929. Canada was there representing the British Crown.
And what were you thinking about when you were sitting in that jail cell?
I thought a lot about a lot of things. Being in jail is not an easy thing, and it impressed upon me the need for Indian people to stand up and fight for their rights. It's time. There is no middle ground left, and for Indian people to say that we have always been regarded as nations, we need to act as nations now.
Now, you, along with the other KI leaders, were eventually set free by an appeals court judge. Can you tell us a little bit about what that appeals court judge ruled when they set you free?
That was actually a panel of three judges of the Appellate Court of Ontario. And we challenged the sentencing that we received on a number of grounds. One was that the judge didn't take into consideration the GLADU provisions under the criminal court, and we argued that those should be extended to civil proceedings as well, and the appellate court agreed with us. They also agreed that the judge, Judge Cunningham of the Superior Court, should have taken into consideration the customary law of the Algonquin people in looking at how Canadian law should be applied in that case, and the appellate court upheld that. In fact, our lawyer, Sarah Dover, in sentencing, argued that in that very courthouse there is a stained glass window, and it says that Canadian law is built up of British common law, French civil code, and traditional Aboriginal customary laws. And she said that if they didn't agree with that, they should take that window out of that courthouse.
All right.
With the time that remains, let's give an ear to their discussion, with special attention to how the multidimensional issues of sovereignty and self-determination arise from a range of other considerations. This segment begins with a question for Samuel McKay about the rule of law and moves from there to a discussion by two women practicing Aboriginal law in the Canadian courts. Jean Taillet is a Métis lawyer who explains her own credentials toward the end of the presentation.
Jean, the duty to consult has been in the courts for more than 20 years. What, in your view, is the foremost issue in this ongoing struggle?
Maybe I need to start with picking up on the discussion you just had about one law for all. Part of that, to me, it almost sounds like Lord of the Rings, you know, one ring to rule them all, one ring to bind them, one ring to bring them all, and in the darkness bind them. You know, it kind of sounds, it has that evil sound to it to me. And I don't think it's true. I don't think it's the way our country works now, and I don't think it's the way this country has ever been. This country has been founded on many different kinds of law. So, for example, Quebec has the civil code. That's completely different from the common law that governs the rest of Canada. Military people are run by military law. They don't go into the civil courts. And we have always had Aboriginal law has been at play and working in Canada. So we have cases that go back way, way, way back to the 1600s and 1700s. For example, there's a case called Campbell and Hall that goes back, that recognizes the law, that Aboriginal law governs marriage, and we have laws about custom adoptions, things like that, have always been recognized. So the idea that there is one law is wrong. That's just what That seems to be the common myth out there, but it's absolutely not true. And it never, ever has been true from day one in this country. From the day one that, say, the Europeans came, it has not been so. And even before that, it was not so, because there were many different kinds of Aboriginal people across the country, and they all had their own different laws. Mm-hmm. So this country has always been built on many peoples trying to exist together. So I think that's really important, because the idea of consultation and what is at play and what is the foundation of all that is all about the fact that we're all different kinds of people who have to learn how to live together. And so the root idea here is that we have to respect other peoples and other laws and other peoples who own lands and territories, and we have to work with them. So it really means there is no one great big master up in the sky who gets to, called the crown, who gets to have everything their way and do whatever they want with the land, despite the people who have been here, some of them for thousands and thousands of years. So that's the root idea, is that we're trying to, the fancy word nowadays is called reconciliation. Mm-hmm. That's the word everybody wants to use now. But the real idea is that people have to learn how to live together, in one group of people is not supposed to be better or have more power or over the other people. We should sit down as equals and try and work out what is going to happen with the lands and the resources that are so important to people in this country. That's the idea underneath it. Now, we can talk for many hours about the fact that that's not happening, that the Crown believes that it has all the power and control and cards in its hands. But I think in this one, the courts have been, certainly since 1982, have been trying to lay down a different kind of law. So they started with Sparrow by creating the justification test, right?
That's said the 82?
1990, actually. It came down. In 1982 was when the Constitution constitutionalized Aboriginal rights and treaty rights. But 1990 was when Sparrow came down, and that was a fishing case out of BC. And basically what it said was that the Crown can regulate, but if they're going to tromp on Aboriginal rights in the process of that, they got to justify it, and it's got to be, they've got to have a really good reason to say that Aboriginal people can't go fishing, right? And so trumped up reasons aren't going to do it, right? It can't be just, well, we've always been regulating, so we get to continue. None of that's going to work. So that was the first thing the court said, to try and bolster Aboriginal rights. Well, the Crown ignored that in large part, largely across this country. They are very good at implementing policy that looks like they're doing something, and then they don't actually do it. So that's the first thing. And then in 1996, we had the Adams case. And in Adams, they said a very important thing. They were trying to get proactive by this point, because they could see that it wasn't happening. So they're trying to get proactive, and they said, look, government, you can't implement a whole regime that stands to infringe Aboriginal rights all the time without some guidelines for your people. You can't do that. You just can't do it anymore. We're not going to let you do it. Well, that was the first kind of shot across the bow in terms of trying to get ahead. So you didn't have to go to court and get charged, right? It was them saying in advance, government, you have to change what you're doing. And we tried to tell you in Sparrow, and you didn't listen 6 years ago. So we're going to tell you now again. Well, that was 1996, okay? And they still didn't listen. So we ended up in Taku River. And actually, I was co-counsel on Taku River on the case all the way to the Supreme Court of Canada. And that's the court coming down yet again and saying to government, now we're going to tell you that you have to consult with people. And in some cases, you have to get their consent if it's a serious issue. And you've got to sit down and talk to them. And that was an even more serious shot across the bow. So, and then they followed that up. That's Taku and Haida. And then they followed it up a year and a half later with Mikisew, where they said, oh, and by the way, this applies to the old treaties as well. And so they are, I think the court, the Supreme Court of Canada, is in bearing in mind that they're cautious conservative people, okay, they are in their own cautious conservative way trying to push government to do the right thing. Now, the question then becomes, why isn't government doing it? And that's a question that lots of people can talk about. But I think that's the move, the direction they're going in. And my own analysis is that if government doesn't fundamentally change, the courts are going to push them further.
That was Jean Taillet. Joan Jack is a lawyer and an Anishinaabe who worked on negotiations at Taku River.
Okay. Joan, maybe we'll talk with you about what you would like to say is at the heart of this duty. What's at the heart of this duty for you as Anishinaabe Kwe?
I think what's at the heart of it is that as Anishinaabe people or Indigenous people all over North America is that we want our freedom now. You know, and that's the problem. You know, with all due respect to the Supreme Court of Canada, who am I to say anything negative about them, you know, but I understand that, as Jean said, they're cautiously moving forward. In the meantime, you know, we want freedom now. You know, we never signed numbered treaties to give everything away. That's not what happened. You know, who in their right mind, and I did check, you know, who in their right mind would get up on Monday? Treaty number 5 was signed in Barron's River, Manitoba in 18-something on a Monday. And I don't believe that my ancestors woke up that day and said, I think I'll just give everything away. That's a good idea. You know, who in their right mind would do that? Our oral histories say that the treaties were signed to share with the people who came to our country. You know, we're a sharing, kind people. And I think that that's the problem, is that the entire common law is based on a paradigm that is not ours. You know, it's based on an idea of a land relationship that is not ours. And we are still trying to be heard in our own country. You know, people who are trying to stand up for who they are turned into criminals. You know, that's not right. You know, how can that be fair and just? I mean, I've read all the case law too, and I'm not as good at citing the cases. But what I do know is that when the court talks about a fair and just reconciliation of this issue, they have to look at what's fair and just in our paradigm as well. You know, and how we see things as Indigenous people needs to be taken into consideration. I remember when a lot of memories, and I was listening to everybody talk, are coming into my mind. Like, I remember during the repatriation of the Constitution, and I'm old enough to remember that. And then I remember Mulroney around self-government and the inherent right policy. I remember sitting up and thinking, oh, you know, it's going to come. It's going to come. And basically what he said, what Mulroney said when he was Prime Minister, was you can have self-government as long as you do it like me. So we are free in our own land as long as we are like them. And I don't mean to sound like a crazy person, but that's the truth. If you look at what, you know, that was a good summary of the case evolution that Jean just gave. You know, if you look at what happened between 1990, the cases in 1992, Oka happened. Meech Lake happened. We happened, you know. And that, you know, those people do not create law in a vacuum. You know, they watch the news too. They see what's happening too. And they realize that if they don't look at what's fair and just in the context of who we are, we're going to continue to fight. It doesn't matter that they have a bigger army. You know, I've taught all my children who they are, you know, and that there's going to come a time in their life when they're going to have to decide that it's about responsibility. It's not about rights, my rights. It's about what is your responsibility as Anishinaabe, you know, to your land or Tlingit or whoever we are. So, sorry.
Absolutely, for a very understandable reason. Now, Jean, you talked about the courts pushing the government toward consultation, but have they spelled out what that consultation should be?
No, they haven't, and I actually don't think that's the role of the courts. You really don't want the courts to get involved too deeply in this, really. Really, you don't. They're the wrong people to do this. They're judges. They're not. They give an answer. You don't want them to deeply get involved. You really want, I want Aboriginal people to have a big say in how consultation develops. A big, big, big say in it. So I actually think it's the wrong thing to expect the courts to do that. What the court is there is to push people to have to do it. And I want to actually change the language of the way we're talking tonight. Okay. We should never be talking just about consultation. Consultation is absolutely useless without accommodation. The whole point of consultation is accommodation. And accommodation can mean lots of different things. It can mean that project is not going to happen at all.
That's it for this Monday's World Report. You can listen to the rest of that town hall meeting on the duty to consult over at the website at the Aboriginal Peoples Television Network in the archive for October the 1st, 2008. Next week will be the last World Report for a few months. I'm going to take a break from the routine of a regular weekly report. News about international events from a Canadian perspective still appear on the World Report blog at worldreport.cjoy.net. Meanwhile, check out the links under Editor's Choice. You may be surprised by Pambazuka News' series on Canadian mining in Africa. The authors describe Canadian stock exchanges as global centers for risky investment. Canada's economy is different from the Americans, all right. Get the big picture by clicking on the link to the Bretton Woods Project's collection on the international financial architecture, or Brendan Orrell's report on Canadian gold giant Barrick's operation on Western Shoshone land. You might also be surprised to learn that Lebanon's Washington-friendly government has asked Iran to supply it with mid-sized weapons. Find out what that means from articles listed in the Editor's Choice box at worldreport.cjoy.net. You can retrieve a podcast or leave a comment at that same website. Send email directly to worldreport@cjoy.net or snail mail to Box 767, Nelson, Canada, V1L5R4, Attention World Report. Thanks to rebroadcasters Mike Cannon at The Mike Cannon Show in Wausau, Wisconsin, and to Amber Heeb at CHLY Nanaimo. To the band Married to Music for the World Report theme music from their vinyl album, Miracles, and to Sidewinder's Coffee Company for sponsoring the World Report Question of the Week. Above all, thanks to you for listening. I'm Jim Terrell at World Report for Kootenai Co-op Radio in Nelson, British Columbia. If you're listening in the evening, The Bioneers is coming up after the station break, so stay tuned. If you're listening in the morning, KCR Stories will be next.